Welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network, where we bring together official Washington policymakers, DC insiders, and AI experts who are challenging, debating, and just trying to figure out the rules of the road for artificial intelligence. The Washington AI Network, along with Nets Club, hosted a breakfast event to celebrate UK Ambassador Dame Karen Pierce's 5 years in Washington, D.C. Here's a conversation in front of an audience of members of Congress, diplomats, tech innovators, media, and members of the Washington AI Network. I want to start by talking about the AUKUS Alliance, because you played such a critical role. Can you talk about, what is it, like 3 years now, and how that's changed things?
Great. I think that's a great question. So thank you, Tammy, and hello, everybody, and thank you for coming. So if you go back to the 1950s, when we were all in a nervous state after the end of the Second World War and the Cold War is just beginning, and Britain and America developed out of the Manhattan Project a pooling their nuclear technology and resources. And part of that was all about naval, and part of it was about nuclear reactors powering submarines. Not nuclear weapons on submarines, that's different, but how you get something called nuclear propulsion. And nuclear is the bedrock of the very special bilateral agreement we have had with the Americans since 1958. And that agreement has continued unchanged until 3 years ago, as you say, where the Australians' desire to have a nuclear-powered submarine so that they could make more of a contribution in the Indo-Pacific to security and stability and prosperity. They asked us to help. We talked to the Americans. And then for only the second time in history, that nuclear-powered technology has been shared with another country from America, and that's Australia. So together, we will build these submarines. They will be at the disposal, as it were, of the cause of peace in the Indo-Pacific, and that's called Pillar One. And in Pillar Two, we have a really exciting set of technological projects to make sure that the US, Australia, and the UK beat the competition, which often means China, in new technologies and can develop together really advanced systems, civilian as well as military, that are going to keep the peace and stability. And it's really exciting to think that all our scientists can collaborate on that.
So it's 3 years later. How has it changed things? The way you want?
It's definitely going in the right direction. Very sadly, you cannot build a submarine overnight.
Too bad.
It is too bad.
Or anything nuclear.
But it's
going
well.
But I mean, has it changed the relationship with China? I mean, has it changed things?
I think it has let the Chinese know two things that are important. One is that America and Britain really care about what happens in the Indo-Pacific, not just about freedom of navigation, not just about trade routes. We really care about the security of the Indo-Pacific. And it lets them know that Australia is now going to play a much bigger role in that. So in other words, it's not two countries coming in, as it were. I know you're a Pacific nation too, but fundamentally, the Chinese are now, if you like, aware that we mean what we say, and that Australia is a very powerful and capable, more capable ally in that way. What it's done technologically is bring a huge number of interesting companies together to start looking at things like quantum, underwater weaponry, underwater technology. So it's starting. I wouldn't say I could show you a physical thing, but in terms of the effect on world peace, to use a phrase, I think that's been a really net positive.
Fantastic. Okay, we had to go to Afghanistan. I've always wanted to ask you this. Did you ask for that job? I mean, how long were you ambassador?
I did ask for it. And I asked
And by the
for
way,
it.
That tells us everything about you.
No, well, that's very nice of you. Up until that point, my postings in the Foreign Office had been Tokyo, Washington, New York, and Geneva. And I'd not been anywhere difficult. And I thought, well, if I want to get to the highest levels of the Foreign Office, I got to put more into the pot. There are other people in the Foreign Service going to all these really difficult places. So I thought, I will pick a really difficult place, and I will go there for 2 years. And so I volunteered to do that. I must say, getting on the plane to actually go out, say goodbye to Charles. I was thinking, will I actually ever see London? Yeah,
Charles drinking
again?
Heavily over there for those that can't see to that side of the room.
And in the end, I didn't do 2 years. I did 1 year because I was asked to come back to London to do a different job. But I must say, in terms of serving alongside Americans, military and civilian, that was the most amazing experience. And it wasn't at the time that we saw leading up to the Taliban takeover in 2021. This was a time when there was hope for Afghanistan. It was always ever going to have a shallow trajectory, but what we were doing, both economically and security rise, was working and really important. And I worked very closely with Americans and the military in that.
And today, do you think there's any chance to convince the Taliban to bring girls back into the fold, to help them get educated? Is there any opportunities to negotiate at all?
I think there are differences, from what I see, there are differences of view within the Taliban leadership about this. There are those who, and this is all relative, so when I say there are those who want to reach out to the West, that's not like most countries reaching out, but there are people in the leadership who do understand that this is harmful to their ability to get foreign loans, to get foreign aid. It's also harmful to the country of Afghanistan because you've got half your population not working, not productive, not learning, kept indoors fundamentally. But the people who are actually at the top of the Taliban right now are incredibly hardline about the position of women. And there are even moves to put up more curtains in the very small windows that compounds already have, so no one can look in and see a woman. And this is getting to levels of absurdity. But it is also quite clear that at the moment, the Taliban have such a grip on society and indeed on their own movement that exhortations from us are probably not the way to go. At the time of the withdrawal, we worked with Qatar and also Turkey. And I think we are just going to have to do more of that. And it won't be as fast as we would like. And it won't be as dramatic as we would like. But it is probably the best way to get any change at all.
Do you think those countries are motivated to help?
They were certainly very helpful just after withdrawal as well as during withdrawal. And I think Qatar, I think for different reasons, but Qatar is making itself a real enabler in the Middle East. We saw their role with the Gaza Israeli hostages. And I think Turkey, France always said of Turkey that they were ambivalent about Turkey coming into the EU. They didn't really want to expand the EU, but they would say of Turkey that she has puissance, she has power. And I think what we're seeing in the first quarter of the 21st century is the power of Turkey coming back, and Turkey wants to be a player.
You have a great quote in British Vogue about that in the air in Washington, there's power. By the way, she said there's glamour in New York, so I don't know. I thought we looked pretty good today.
I think we look pretty
but,
good.
But do you feel that sense of power changing with the new Trump administration? Is there more power in the air? Is there less power in the air? How do you look at it?
I think on that particular point, it's just here in Washington. It's almost the minute you get within the city, there are particles of power.
Right.
Not fewer than there used to be when we were here 30 years ago, but it's now diluted because Washington is a more normal city, for want of a better phrase. There are more things to do. The Kennedy Center has a broader program. The theaters have a broader program. The restaurants are better, if I may say so. The Wharf is fantastic. So that the proportion of power is perhaps smaller of the whole, but it's still a very powerful city, and it's a fantastic city.
I'm so glad you said that.
I think it's the best city in the world after London.
Tell Walter to move back. Come on. What's he doing? It snows here, too. You don't have to wait for the snow to come to New Orleans. Okay, I have to ask you about Ukraine. You spent so much time working on the various issues with the ambassador's White House. What do you think comes next? Do you think the Trump administration, I know you don't want to predict the Trump administration or any Washington administration, but what do you think the next opportunity is for Ukraine with this administration?
So I'm very encouraged by President Trump's pronouncements on peace through strength. I think that's incredibly important in the Ukrainian context. And I think in General Kellogg, as his Ukraine envoy, he has a very fine public servant who has a lot of understanding about the Russians and a lot of understanding about the issues on the ground. So I'm confident that together we can work together and we can find a way forward that helps the Ukrainians and ultimately brings stability back. But it won't be easy. I'm not going to pretend it's easy. I'm not even going to pretend that Putin is queuing up to negotiate. But I think the strength aspect of this, peace through strength, is exactly the right way to approach it.
Okay. The new prime minister, Keir Starmer, what is his relationship with President Trump?
Oh, they got on very well. They've talked a few times on the telephone. They had dinner together in September in the margins of the UN General Assembly. The president was very gracious and invited the prime minister and foreign secretary to his personal apartment in Trump Tower.
Oh.
Which has the
Did
most
you get to go?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Oh, do tell.
Going to miss an opportunity like that. I was going to say, you have the most fantastic view of New York. And one of the things that really struck me about President Trump was his love of the city and his knowledge of the city. He's in that sense a true New Yorker. I don't know if people thank you for saying they're a true New Yorker, but right. What I'm trying to convey is his deep affection for this city. And that was very interesting, and that was good to talk about that for a while. And then we got on to the economy. Both the president and prime minister share this very deep need to revitalize our economies, to put a lot of emphasis on growth and jobs. Mm-hmm. And as President Trump said, you know, we come from different political traditions. Prime Minister is obviously the Labour Party. President Trump is Republican. But that doesn't mean we can't work together. And if we disagree, I think that's fine. The important thing is that we understand on a particular issue why we disagree and what are we going to do to get around it.
Okay, Peter Mandelson is your successor.
Yes.
What can you tell us about him?
Oh, well, I'm sure many people already know Peter. He worked for Tony Blair. He was Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, which in our system is an incredibly important and tricky job. But it was his job to curate the Good Friday Agreement and take that forward. He's a very good businessman. He's run his own firm. Does a lot of business with New York, but he'll divest himself of that. And above all, I think he's a really good trade expert. He went on to be the European Commissioner for Trade. He's done a lot of negotiating. He's got very good political and policy instincts. He loves America. He's just done an interview for Fox about President Trump, saying how much he looks forward to working with President Trump, how much he respects his approach on things like China. I think it's fair to say Peter is one of those people in the British system whose views on China have evolved. David Cameron would be another, so it's not a party political thing. Mm-hmm. And I would commend his article to everybody. It's on Fox about how his views have changed. And he is going to be a really important partner for the new administration.
What advice have you given him?
Oh, my God.
Yes.
The same advice I give everybody coming to Washington. There's no opportunity not worth taking. Do everything.
Oh, I like that. We got to talk about AI. We're the Washington AI Network, and the UK led the first AI safety summit. You were there right in the middle. Will the UK stay in a leadership role? We've got France coming up next, right? There's some everyone's counting down, I know, here to the AI Action Ooh. Summit. What's your take? Because you're on the front lines of that. Again, your whole career is alliances, and this is a new alliance.
I think it's going to be one of those phrases where every summit has a different adjective before the word summit. So we had safety, France will have action, someone else will have innovation, you know. But and that's fine because the continuum of this, even though AI moves very fast, the continuum of policymaking on this across several countries is really important. And this is where Peter Mandelson will be really helpful. He knows a lot more about AI than I do. I think he's going to get really stuck into this agenda. We know it's important to the White House. I think UK will definitely stay engaged. It's an odd thing to say when you think of how big the American and Chinese economies are. But the British economy is sixth largest in the world. We are the third largest in terms of AI, which is really quite astounding. Now, there may be quite a gap between America and China and the UK, but the point is we're the third, and we obviously want to build on that, and we want to develop our skills as a tech superpower. So this area is an incredibly important one, and I know that Peter will be spending a lot of time on it.
Great. Okay, I have to turn to Queen Elizabeth because you're the last ambassador.
Yes, I was.
During her reign.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Boy, what an experience, right, to be there with her and how people feel about her. Can you just give us your thoughts on her?
She defines the United Kingdom for so many of us. She's both a person and an institution. And she was very well aware of that. She had a great phrase. She said, "I have to be seen to be believed." And she was very good at undertaking engagements for that reason and holding things. I had to phone her just after I got to Washington because I hadn't been able to have an audience before I went out. It's a very strange thing to talk to the Queen on the telephone, let me tell you. But she has a very deep knowledge of America, not just because she's met 13 of the past American presidents. In some ways, you would expect that from a British head of state. But when she was a young girl, she was taught English constitutional history to prepare her for being queen, because it was always assumed she would be, as her uncle was not married at the time. And the master at Eton College, which is just across the river over a little footbridge from Windsor Castle, she'd walk there every day for her English constitutional lessons. But he was also an expert in American history, and he would throw in American history for good measure. So she had a very deep understanding, and she read all our cables, as does the King, really asked really good questions about American politics. And for anyone who hasn't seen it, I would commend what she said in Philadelphia when she came for the bicentennial, about what America represents, the ideals and ideas America represents, and how the Brits tried too long to hang on to America, but how we learnt from what America was and became. And I think it's the most beautiful passage of all the things I wish I'd written in briefing. That would be it.
Were you there when President Trump went to London and was with the Queen?
No, I was in New York then. That was my predecessor, Kim.
Well, they got along really well.
They got along extremely well. We have some lovely photos up in the embassy of President Trump and the First Lady meeting the Queen and Prince Philip. And they're smiling. Everyone's happy. It's a great photo. And, you know, the palace thought they were wonderful guests. They're very, very pleased to have them.
Okay, can you give us a health update on King Charles? How's he doing? I always wanted to ask that, right? Like, how's the King? It used to be Larry King. Simone liked that. All right, for the podcast, I'll say in a straight way.
He'd be very pleased to know that you're asking.
This is why you're the best of all time. Come on, guys. Come on now.
He really hopes to be able... he and Camilla, Queen Camilla, know America incredibly well. He'd love to get back here. He's got very many friends in America, some in Washington.
Will we see them soon?
We can never put dates on those things, but okay. I know that he'd love to come back. I know that we'd love to receive the President and First Lady in the UK. So I'm sure, given that desire on both sides, we can find a way forward.
Okay. All of your time in Washington, is there a piece of history? Is there something in particular that caught your attention or that you loved more than any other? Was there a surprise that you like? We're going to wrap up. And I just wondered if there's anything that you think about when you think about your time here in Washington.
Oh, just being in Washington makes me smile. The very first time I came, we drove along Rock Creek Parkway for some politico-military talks at State Department. And I thought, I can't believe you drive through a park to go to work in the world's most important city. And I was hooked from that moment. And then I was even more hooked when we went down to Norfolk and went on an aircraft carrier. So in this role, I went out to the Gerald R. Ford at sea, which is the most amazing aircraft carrier. And I watched F-18s taking off. I love F-18s. I also went to something very strange about me. I also went to open the Miramar Air Show, which is more F-18s.
Oh, my God.
But there have been just so many wonderful moments. We were both at the White House for the Elton John conference, the concert. We had the honor to go to Pearl Harbor for the 80th anniversary. I get goosebumps at Arlington. This is just the most wonderful posting. And we are so lucky to have been with all of you here. The one thing that did surprise me, when the Queen died, we had a queue. It was a very good queue. It would have done credit to any British queue. Outside the embassy of ordinary citizens come to pay their respects. And some of them were kind enough to leave tributes and bring flowers, and children wrote poems. Some of those people queued for 8 hours. That was amazing. And I think I was surprised. I mean, obviously it was wonderful, but I think we were all very surprised and moved by that. So I think it's another symbol of the fact that the people-to-people bonds are still there. And it's our job, it'll be Peter's task to keep those going, as well as all the policy and operations stuff.
Well, we wish you all the best.
Well, thank you.
And we have...
Oh, my God.
Rohit Chopra and I designed this special gift for you.
Can I open it?
Please.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Well, I find it very hard to say what I think about America, because it really is a second home. And I'm going to start crying if I try and tell you what I think about America. But it has been the most enormous honor to represent the King, the Queen, and the United Kingdom here. And I won't see any more because we're on camera. But thank you, everybody. Thank you for taking us into your homes and your hearts and your work. This is the most important alliance. And wherever I go, whatever I do, I'm going to do my best to keep it like that.
Thank you. You can just slide it off this way.
Like, slide it off. Yeah, Tammy's getting bored of me.
No, hardly.
Trying to open this. This is amazing. Oh, my goodness. Okay, everybody. Right, watch out.
You have to read it. There's a note
on it. This is... this is fantastic. So can I read it to you? It says... this is for champagne opening and also marine barracks, which we forgot in 1812, which is why it's so beautiful. This says, Karen, forever the Dame of DC, December 31st, 2024. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.